What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, we would love to get that question answered for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Okay, get that again? Text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And if you would prefer to send us an email, that's perfectly acceptable, ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. Matt Gabinski is our phone screener. We also have Rich Jesse handling social media for us. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we are streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box, if you would, please. All right. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Great. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing decent, thanks.
Pretty toasty weather we're having.
Yeah, but it's better than it was this weekend.
Yeah. This weekend was just crazy here in Birmingham. We had extremely hot weather. We went to a Italian festival that was held at a very historic site here in Birmingham. And the weather, you know, if you looked at the weather forecast hour by hour, it said sunny, 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 sunny. So we thought, great, this will be great. We get there, we're there for about 30 minutes, all of a sudden, here comes the rain. It was as they say here, a frog strangler. It was so bad. We had to leave. I mean, it was just that bad. But that's the weather. You deal with whatever you have to deal with. Here's an email that we received from an anonymous listener. I love your program. I learn a lot. It allows me to answer my husband's questions. He is a non-practicing Presbyterian, but he goes to church with me. So here's my question. Why are Catholics not allowed to divide the ashes of a cremated body while at the same time preserve relics, which can be body parts of saints, and then distribute those relics all over the world? Thank you, Anonymous.
Yeah, thanks. So the rationale for dividing up the body parts and ashes and cremation, and the rationale for the way we distribute the relics of saints are very, very different. So generally speaking, when people cremate and dispose of those ashes in some way other than the way specified by the church, which is namely place them in a columbarium or in a tomb or some sort of place that's been designated, you know, specially for the dead, it's either because they have some superstitious notions like, you know, I want to have my ashes scattered over the Ganges or the Pacific Ocean or, you know, the Smoky Mountain National Forest or something, and you know, out of some sentiment that, you know, perhaps my spirit will be diffused in this sacred place that I like or that I value. Well, that's a superstitious notion of the afterlife, and really has nothing to do with the Christian doctrine of the dignity of the body and the resurrection of the dead. Or sometimes they want to distribute them to family members as a kind of memorial or keepsake, as if you could reduce the body of your loved one to, you know, something like a, you know, the participation trophy you got from the neighborhood bowling league, you know. And again, that sort of goes against the spirit of the Catholic understanding of the dignity of the body, the proper care to be taken for the dead, and ultimately our belief in the resurrection. Whereas when the relics of the saints are distributed, they are distributed specifically for veneration. That is to treat them with incredible honor. Saint Gregory of Nyssa once said that in venerating the relics of saints, we are really venerating Christ and his members. And it goes absolutely and directly to the Christian idea that the body of a Christian is part of the body of Christ and will participate in the resurrection.
Okay. And we appreciate that. Thanks so much for your anonymous question. Here is one now from Henrietta. She says, I am a practicing Catholic, and I have a question for Dr. Anders regarding the prayer, Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and forever shall be, world without end.
Let me guess. Let me guess. What is this world without end business?
You got it. She says, I seem to recall in my Catholic teachings that the end of the world will happen someday. How then does the prayer recite this world without end in the prayer? This seems to be contradictory to me.
Yep, we get that question all the time.
Yep.
So the English language version of the Glory Be,
yes,
offers, in my judgment, an infelicitous translation of the Latin phrase in secula seculorum, which means unto the ages of ages.
Hmm.
And so that's the meaning of it. So it's the Blessed Trinity that has no end.
Yeah.
Not the temporal universe that is a creature.
You think that might ever be changed?
You know, liturgical forms are rather sticky.
Hmm.
Right? And for very good reason. You don't want to mess with liturgical prayer once it becomes sort of, you know, locked in place,
yeah,
by custom and law. For obvious reasons.
But it has happened sometimes, right? I mean...
Sure, yeah. But I mean, this is, in my judgment, will it ever change? No. That's my judgment, you know.
Very good. Henrietta, thank you so much for your email. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, here is the address, ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. On each of our live programs, we like to do at least one or two emails if we can sneak them in there somewhere. And then once a month or so, we'll do a mailbag program. And on the mailbag program, we'll do all kinds of emails that have come in over the past couple of weeks. Again, the address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Always enjoy reading all of your emails when they come in. And I promise, even though we can't get to each and every email, we do read all of them. Sometimes we'll get two or three emails that are almost identical, word for word, from different people in different parts of the world. And then we'll kind of, you know, combine those so that we can, you know, give you the right answer that you're looking for. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Emma, a caller from St. Louis. We'll also hear from Elizabeth in Albany, New York, watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN if you have a question for Dr. David Anders. 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN Radio. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. We have two lines open as we speak, 833-288-3986. Let me tell you about a wonderful new book from EWTN's religious catalog, Defending Boyhood, by Anthony Esselin. In this great book, Anthony draws on his own all-American boyhood, at times wistfully, at times playfully, at times prophetically, in the literal sense of employing the thunder of an Old Testament prophet. He details what a good boyhood once was and what it can be again, despite the threats of our precious sons and daughters face from political correctness and the blurring of the distinction between boys and girls. He prescribes a return to sanity. While Anthony may not be able to change the world, his book can certainly take us into the world of boyhood that just may change you and the lives of the boys that you love. It's available now from EWTN's religious catalog, EWTNRC.com, buy Catholic, shop Catholic, EWTNRC.com. Again, the title of that book, Defending Boyhood, by Anthony Esselin. That should be a winner.
You know, Tom, I never thought we'd be in a position to have to say this, but I am so grateful for Catholic schools and Catholic education for my children because I'm happy to put my kids in institutions where they tell my sons that they're sons and my daughters that they're daughters.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are places in the country, in the world, where you don't have that.
I know. Certainly plenty to pray about, isn't it?
Yep.
All right. If you're ready now, let's get to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. And we're going to begin today with Emma. I just lost my screen here. Hold on 1 second. Emma is in St. Louis, and she's listening on the Great Covenant Network. Hey there, Emma. What's on your mind today? Emma, hi.
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry. So I was reading Genesis earlier, and I'm reading the part after the flood. Noah has too much wine, and he falls asleep, and I guess he's naked, and says that his son Ham walks in his tent and sees that his father is naked, and I think it says something like he takes advantage of his father's nakedness, and then after he wakes up, his two other sons tell him what Ham did, and then Noah curses Ham's son, Canaan. And I was just kind of, I wasn't sure what they meant by, like, his advantage of it. Do you know what that
means? Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, admittedly, the passage is obscure, and I don't want to obscure the obscurity. I want to embrace the obscurity and draw attention to the fact that it is not entirely clear. There are some clues, there are some hints that we can find in other biblical passages that use the same phraseology. So in Leviticus chapter 20, for example, there are a number of sexual practices and sexual liaisons that are forbidden to the children of Israel, and they are often described in terms of having uncovered someone's nakedness. So, you know, it'll say, for example, you know, don't lie with your father's wife. You will uncover her nakedness. And if you do so, both parties have to be put to death. I mean, that sort of thing. And you find that kind of language in several places in the Old Testament, which associate uncovering someone's nakedness with illicit sexual activity. So are we to understand from that in this passage, that Ham violated his inebriated father sexually? That is a plausible interpretation of the passage. It may not be the only one, but it's the only one that's presented by that language being found in other parallel passages. Maybe, and perhaps it's just a matter of having seen him naked, and that also would have been an unseemly thing in the culture at the time. But in any regard, it was seen to be, you know, in the element of purity and chastity and prudence, a very inappropriate thing that Ham did. Now, the larger context is, you know, the book of Genesis is not written just to give us sort of the drama of the Noah and his family, but these things are written, St. Paul tells us, for our sake.
Sure,
they are emblematic of other realities. Now, you know, most scholars think that the book of Genesis, the origins of the thing, lie in, you know, lost in antiquity past, but the present state of the text, you know, came into its form, you know, post-Davidic Empire. And there is a clear note of a sort of royal apology that runs through there to justify the Davidic monarchy and the Davidic Empire. You know, the role of Judah, for example, is constantly highlighted as a kind of parallel to David. And the point of the Ham narrative, Noah's curse, he says, cursed be Canaan. That was Ham's son, the lowest of slaves. It definitely seems aimed at the idea of justifying the conquest of the land of Canaan by Israel. And the argument given was that the Canaanites were, among other things, sexually immoral. So I think what we may be seeing here is, you know, rather than simply a narrative about events in the life of Noah and his son Ham, mm-hmm. A kind of symbolic referent that was understood in the contemporary culture to have justified the conquest of Canaan and the Canaanites that were understood by the Israelites to be intrinsically immoral people who engaged in this kind of behavior. And that's clearly the language that God uses during the Exodus about the Canaanites. They did these things, and therefore I'm going to dispossess them. And if you Israelites do these things, I'm going to dispossess you too.
Yeah. Caveat emptor.
Yep.
All right. Emma, thank you so much. We hope that is helpful for you. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. One line open, 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Let's go to Elizabeth now in Albany, New York, watching us on YouTube. Hello, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom and Dr. Anders. Nice to speak with you today. As I explained to your screener, and I've called in before, I am a newly practicing Catholic, and I'm just exploring Darwinian evolution theory and trying to grasp my how I should approach the book of Genesis. And I'm looking at Genesis for the first time in my life in a non-literal way, but more so in an allegorical way. So my challenge and what I'm struggling with right now, and I would like to know a little bit, Dr. Enders, of how you dealt with this if you didn't believe in evolution before becoming Catholic. What I'm struggling with right now is if Genesis is primarily an allegorical text, why, and this is definitely speculative theology here, but why would God not want to tell us how we came to be, like what our origins are, why leak that out of the Bible and
okay.
give us an account?
Yeah, sure. I really understand. I understand and appreciate the question deeply. So let me make a couple of preliminary remarks because your question seems to presume, if I heard you right, maybe I didn't, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, becoming Catholic obligates one to become a Darwinian. And that seemed to be maybe implied in your question. And I want to emphasize that Darwinian evolution, natural selection, are not part of Catholic doctrine. And so what one is obligated to believe upon becoming Catholic are the dogmas of the Catholic faith. That's what you're obligated to believe. That's the deposit of faith given to us by divine revelation. And so I'm not obligated to believe in Darwinian evolution any more than I'm obligated to believe in, say, you know, the latest speculative theory in astrophysics. You know, I don't have to believe in like the multiple universe hypothesis, or I don't have to necessarily adopt the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics. You know, I mean, I'm not obligated by Catholic faith to hold these or any other particular theories. Now, what I am obligated to do as a Catholic is I'm obligated to the thesis that faith and reason never contradict. And so I always have to be in a kind of critical dialogue between faith and culture, faith and reason. And I have to allow them to mutually penetrate one another. So faith definitely enters into my assessment of rational evidence.
Uh-huh.
But rational evidence also enters into my assessment of Catholic faith and the way I apply it to my own life. And so, you know, a classic example of how that has worked out in history is in the 16th century, there were Catholics who basically adopted the Hellenistic, Aristotelian, Ptolemaic view of the universe, that the earth was the center of the universe and the sun went around the earth. And that was the scientific theory of the day and seemed to be confirmed by observation. But they also found it easy to read the Bible in light of that theory, right? Because, you know, the Bible talks about the sun rising and the sun setting God stopping the sun in the sky during, you know, the Joshua's battles and so forth. And so when Copernicus floated his heliocentric model and Galileo picked it up, Cardinal Bellarmine, who was the chief theologian of the Vatican at the time, talks to Galileo and he says, look, Galileo, you know, I think you're wrong. I think that science and observation, empirical data, as well as scripture are against you. However, if you can show me with evidence that the heliocentric theory is actually true, well, then I obviously have made a mistake in the way I've interpreted the faith.
Mm.
And I'll go back and I'll reinterpret the faith accordingly. Now, let me contrast that with the fundamentalist attitude. The fundamentalist attitude is, I just infallibly know what the Bible says. My interpretation of the Bible is irreformable. And if reason or evidence says otherwise, so much the worse for reason and evidence. And so I grew up around some fundamentalists who recognized things like, you know, the data from astrophysics suggests that the universe is, you know, what, you know, so many billions of years old.
Yeah.
And whereas they thought that Genesis taught that the world was 10,000 years old. And the way they handled that was to say, well, God must have created the world 10,000 years ago, because that's what the Bible says. God must have created the world 10,000 years ago, but he created it with the appearance of being 5 billion. Right?
Huh.
He gave it the appearance of age, right? So you know, the red shift and the, you know, the motion of the galaxies. So that was already in motion at the instant he created it. He created old galaxies already floating away from one another.
Okay.
You know? Now, there's absolutely no empirical evidence for that. You understand? That's just an ad hoc theory that allows them to retain their dogmatic commitment to the idea of a 10,000-year-old universe. Well, a Catholic won't do that, because what that does is that kind of ad hoc reasoning utterly destroys the power of induction. Like, induction's already a philosophical problem. Hume showed us that. But that kind of ad hoc thesis says, well, you can just never know anything inductively. And Islam took that principle very seriously. So a famous Islamic philosopher named Al-Ghazali maintained that God is the immediate cause of everything that happens. And so what appear to be physical causes are just ephemera. They're just appearances. And he famously said, fire doesn't burn a cotton ball. God burns the cotton ball in the presence of the fire, right? And that kind of reason, it destroys your ability to do science.
Yeah.
Or really to do any kind of rational thinking. So, but the Catholic faith says, no, you have to admit the data of reason. Now, it may be that, you know, that 500 years from now, people have a completely different biological model or completely different, you know, astrophysical model, whatever it might be, whatever scientific theory is under consideration. And so what all being Catholic obligates you to is you have to be open to the data of reason. And if you're persuaded, you know, rationally, well, hey, I think natural selection is the best theory available to explain the diversity of species, well, then, you know, you're going to do your theology accordingly. But that's not the theory itself is not taught by the Catholic faith as a dogma. I just want to get that out of the way. Okay. Now, in terms of the purpose of Genesis, so the Catholic faith does hold to the literal interpretation of every passage of the Bible. But what do we mean by literal? That's a really key question. So the fundamentalist thinks that take every sentence out of context in its plain denotative sense, as the man of the street would understand it if you put it on a flashcard, you know, put it right in front of his face. And that's not what we mean by literal. What we mean by literal is, what is the sense that the sacred author had in mind when he wrote this text? And so to answer those kind of questions, we have to look at things like, what's the genre of the literature? Mm-hmm. What is its context? You know, where was it situated in the life and community of the people who wrote the text, and what purposes for which, you know, did they use it? So obviously, we pick up the Psalms. You know, we actually have little superscriptions in the Psalms that say, you know, for the director of music with stringed instruments.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious what they were composed for, right? And so you read them with that in mind. You know, you don't read them as a literal description of, say, ancient battles or whatever. You read them as songs of worship.
Sure.
Okay? When you pick up the book of Job, the genre of literature tells you this is poetic wisdom literature. It's not the, you know, the best-selling tell-all memoir, New York Times, you know, reporter of a dude named Job, right? It's a poetically composed narrative to deal with the problem of evil and suffering. That's what the genre tells you.
Mm-hmm.
The genre of the book of Genesis is myth, and I don't mean by that it's untrue. I mean it's written as a story that captures perennial spiritual and moral issues in the form of an origin narrative, right? And that's the literal meaning of the text. The literal meaning is derived from the genre of literature that it is. And one of the major themes of the book of Genesis, the purposes, I think, of writing it, is to contrast precisely the idea of God's creative activity in relationship to the world in comparison to, say, what ancient Near Eastern myth, like the Babylonian myth of the Enuma Elish, would teach by contrast, right? So I do think there's questions about how God made us and why that are answered in the book, but not in answer to the kind of questions you're asking. You have to ask, what questions does the book pose that it wants us to know the answers to? I can touch on this a little bit when we come back from the break.
Elizabeth, stay with us. We'll have lots more for you on Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN on this Wednesday afternoon with Dr. David Anders here to answer your questions at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-EWTN. 888-298-3986. Before the break, we were talking with Elizabeth in Albany. She asked, among other things, if Genesis isn't literal, well, why doesn't God just tell us our origins?
Yeah, thanks. So I ran a bit long before. I apologize. I wanted to talk about the relationship of faith and reason in the Catholic Church and what the literal sense of Scripture is in Catholic hermeneutical theory. We do believe in the literal sense, but not in the same way that fundamentalists do. And but the short answer to the question is, why doesn't God tell us everything about our own biological origins, the kind of data that you would get in a biology class or an anthropology class? And I think it would be the same reason that, you know, God didn't give us the periodic table or you know, Newton's laws or as I mentioned earlier, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, right? I mean, like, there's a lot of things that are true about reality that are not immediately relevant to my moral and spiritual and existential situation. And the primary concern of sacred scripture is our relationship to God and other people, which is principally a moral one. You know, how do I live the life of the virtues and live the life of charity? And I can do that without a lot of that information. Doesn't mean that information is unimportant. Doesn't mean that information cannot help elaborate my understanding of the life of charity and the virtues. I mean, like, say, the better I understand the biology or psychology of the human person, the better I'm able to care for my fellow human being and maybe provide medical care or charity or therapy or whatever it might be. And the opportunity to learn and study those things is a way for the human person to develop and, you know, stretch our wings, so to speak, and have meaningful activity in the world. I mean, God gave us things to accomplish. The metaphor of tilling the earth and being fruitful and multiplying, it captures that in the book of Genesis, that we got a job description, which is to perfect ourselves and the world and our knowledge of it for the sake of the common good, for the glory of God. And so, you know, God left, he left some clues buried around, but left a job for us to do to uncover them so that we can live out this call to charity and the virtues, you know, in the course of a narrative of human life.
Elizabeth, is that helpful for you?
Yes, it was. I agree with you, Dr. Enders, that to be Catholic does not mean you have to be Darwinian. You have to accept evolution. The reason why I brought that up is because, for the first time, because of what you said, that we do believe that faith and reason coincide, for the first time, I'm allowing myself to actually investigate the evidence for Darwinian evolution, and I'm finding myself really
compelled.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's really shattering my worldview and how I even view the Bible. So
that's fabulous. I mean, what you're telling me is wonderful. I'm going to just capture the phrase: for the first time ever, I'm allowing myself to contemplate the evidence. Now that right there, I think, that is the essence of rationality. Right? Rationality is not being really smart and knowing a lot of stuff. Rationality is when someone confronts me with evidence that disturbs my worldview or my view of things, am I flexible enough that I can say I might be wrong, that I can change course and go in a different direction? So whether that has to do with my approach to natural science, that's important, right? Vastly more important is when I have theories about human beings. You know, like, so many people get locked into, say, their ideological views or their views about human relationships, or, you know, they may become utterly determined that so-and-so is untrustworthy or base or beneath me, and they're not open to consider that other human being's genuine humanity. Like, could I actually disagree with this human being and not consign them to condemn them as either you know, sort of stupid or you know, sort of willfully corrupt? And the problem with the dogmatist is that, you know, if you don't agree with me, the only option is that you're either dumb or you're just evil, right? And the minute that I can say, well, maybe I'm wrong, it opens up the capacity not only for rationality but for genuine charity.
Yeah.
Right. So that what you just told me, St. Thomas Aquinas tells us that one of the chief parts of the virtue of prudence, that's good decision making, is docility, that I could be teachable. Right. So that I think that is not only in science, that's just critical to the development of all the virtues. Right. And one of the things that makes fundamentalism so dangerous is that that absolute unwillingness to consider the possibility that I could be wrong just can lead to just the grotesque abuse of other human beings.
Yeah, definitely. Elizabeth, good job out of you. Thank you so much for your call. Made me think, as you were saying this, of our dear friend Al Cresta, because he would always, number one, he was always very charitable with everybody, but he was always, you know, willing to listen to what the other person had to say. And he was a great, great listener. And would always say, oh, okay, well, why do you feel this way? Well, okay, maybe I'm wrong about such and such. Or maybe we both need to look at this again.
So let me run on a tangent for just one second.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So the model of theology that developed in the early Middle Ages was of commentary upon sacred texts. And essentially to absorb these authoritative commentaries of the fathers in particular. And in the 12th century, a new model of education started to emerge, and it was what was called dialectic. And that was that you would take texts, whether they be sacred or otherwise, that appeared to be in conflict, and you would line them up against one another and then try to figure out if the antinomies could be reconciled. And the master of this was a guy named Abelard. The master of the older method was Bernard of Clairvaux. And Bernard absolutely couldn't stand Abelard. He just thought Abelard was terrible. Abelard published a book called Sic et Non, Yes and No. And all it was quotations from the fathers that were apparent contradictions. And Bernard's perspective was, you shouldn't teach using that book because you're going to undermine faith in the fathers. You're going to place your own reason ahead of the authority of the church, and that'll lead to skepticism, and that's just a terrible thing. So he wanted to run Abelard out of town. And Abelard had some warts about him. He wasn't a fine human being necessarily, whereas Bernard was a saint. But without a shadow of a doubt, ultimately the person who won out in the history of Catholic intellectual life was Abelard. And the next major figure to take up that dialectical method was Peter Lombard. And any student of Catholic theology has heard that name, because you know that Lombard's sentences, the sententiae, the opinions, was essentially based on Abelard's model. You take quotations from the fathers, and then you enlist students to comment upon them and work out the theoretical difficulties that would emerge. Now, who became the absolute master of dialectic and the master of Catholic theology and a doctor of the church? Well, St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah.
And so if you've ever picked up Aquinas' Summa Theologica, it's not written like it's not written like Bernard of Clairvaux. It's not written in that genre. It's written like Abelard. He takes these antitheses, he takes these antinomies or these contradictions, and he'll say, is there a God? Well, it seems like there's not a God. And he poses an antinomy. And rather than a fundamentalist who just says, well, you know, cursed be you, pox on your house if you say there's no God, Thomas will take seriously the thesis of the other side, whatever it is, whatever the position is.
Yeah.
You know, he'll say, yeah, there's really actually some apparently good grounds for holding what this other guy says. And then he doesn't just knock them down. He doesn't just knock them down. Thomas's dictum, his way of approach was to say, when you're faced with a contradiction, you don't just deny one side of the antinomy. You work in a qualification. When faced with a contradiction, find a qualification. And so the theory was, and it worked out in practice, was that if you take opposition to the faith or to whatever your thesis is seriously and actually give it the strongest hearing possible, you steel man it. What is the best construction of my opponent's argument I can come up with? You will grow. You will learn. And the Catholic faith is not threatened because we think that all truth is God's truth. And so St. Thomas led to real theological growth and wisdom because he was not afraid to enter into dialogue with people that radically disagreed with him. And sometimes he said, you know what, they're right about this. And then he would incorporate that insight into his own theological formulation. And when the church proposed a model for how to think about the integration of faith and wisdom, when Leo XIII wrote a Tiny Patris, who did he say was the example all Catholic intellectuals should follow? That of Thomas Aquinas. So, Bernard of Clairvaux, we love you, but St. Thomas won.
Called to Communion here on EWTN. Glad you could join us on this Wednesday afternoon. I think we have time to get to Mark in Cleveland, listening on AM 1260, The Rock. Hey there, Mark. What's on your mind today, sir?
Oh, hey, good afternoon. wonderful to speak to you both. I have a friend, an apologist, who went to the seminary, and he explains eschaton to me, or the time past death until the resurrection, and, you know, with the parousia rolled in, and, you know, the second coming, and the real end of the world, and the new creation. And I just wanted to get Dr. Anders' take on that post-death, you know, post-mortem until going into heaven, and where do we spend the time in between? Because he seemed to tell me, basically, you die, you get the particular judgment, and then you find a resting place in heaven. Then you come back with Christ in the parousia, you're resurrected, the body's resurrected, and you move on to the new creation.
All right, well, you've not done a bad job, Mark. Honestly, there's not a whole lot to add, but I'll tell you what the church teaches dogmatically, and then we can talk about some of the variable opinions that are allowable. So dogmatically, what the church teaches is that at the end there will be the second coming of Christ, the resurrection of the body from the dead, the final judgment, and then souls will be consigned to heaven or hell. So that's the end of the story. At my personal death, I do face the particular judgment, the church has taught dogmatically that the saints, those who die in the grace of God, without their bodies, do enjoy the vision of God immediately upon death. The saints do. And to call it a vision is a little bit of a misnomer, because you don't have eyeballs, right? If you don't have a body, you don't have physical sight. It really is an intuitive knowledge of God and His essence. Now we don't have an intuitive knowledge of God. We have a kind of shadowy idea of God, but we'll have kind of a direct intuition of God's being, the way I know my own being through introspection, you know, a very, very intimate kind of way. But at the second coming, when the bodies are raised, then that disembodied soul will be reunited with the body, and we go into eternity in an embodied form, albeit the resurrection body will be different from the body we have now in ways that we can't fathom. So that's the main contour. Now, obviously, if you don't get to go straight to the beatific vision, you either get purgatory or you go to hell, but still in a disembodied way until the doctrine of the resurrection. Now, St. Paul tells us that all of creation will be renewed. And so the resurrection of the body is the resurrection of the created order. What that means, what that looks like, no idea. No one does, right? I mean, people have had different theories over the centuries, but all we know is that there's some kind of recreation of the heavens and the earth that we'll participate in. There are other eschatological doctrines that we find in sacred scripture that people speculate about endlessly, none of which have really been formulated as a dogma that all Catholics have to believe.
Okay. Appreciate your call there, Mark. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Congratulations going out to another member of the EWTN radio family. That would be KMMK, FM 88.7. That's in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, celebrating 6 years with us. Congratulations to Tony and Susan May and their great team there at KMMK from all your friends here at EWTN. Before we get back to the phones, earlier we were talking about a new book available from EWTN's Religious Catalog. I want to tell you about another one, Charles Carroll of Carrollton, American Revolutionary. He was the only Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence. This book is a masterfully written biography. Father Charles Connor brilliantly sets the stage for Carroll's extraordinary life by examining his ancestry, the origins of the United States, and the story of the founding of the United States. You're going to learn about the ways that Charles Carroll lived out his faith and his connection to the first bishop of the United States. Again, a wonderful book, Charles Carroll of Carrollton, American Revolutionary. It's available now from the author, Father Charles Connor, through EWTN's Religious Catalog. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic, EWTNRC.com. All right, back to the phones now for Alex, a first-time caller from Anaheim, listening to us today on YouTube. Hey there, Alex. What's on your mind today, sir? Alex, are you there, Alex?
Hey, Alex. Alex, Anaheim, California. Are you there?
Why don't we put him then on hold, if you would, please, going to put him on hold. I want to get to this question here. This is from Therese Marie, watching us right now on Facebook. She says, a devout family member recently passed away unexpectedly. I know he recently went to confession. While he was on life support, the priest imparted the apostolic pardon. Does that mean he will go straight to heaven? I've heard it is not a guarantee, but rather it clears a path. If that's true, under what circumstances would a person not go straight to heaven? And should I continue to pray for his soul?
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate the question. So the apostolic pardon is a plenary indulgence, and the same conditions would apply that apply to any plenary indulgence for its efficacy, and the most important of which is that a person be detached from sin. And so it's possible to have imperfect contrition and to receive a valid absolution without being totally detached from sin. Now, that's not a question that we can judge,
mm-hmm.
right? But clearly, you want to get the last rites of the church, including the apostolic pardon. My friend and mentor, Father Lambert Greenan, always insisted. He said, "Don't forget the Benedictio Apostolica." You know, and he hammered that over and over and over and over and over again. You know, you always want to have the apostolic pardon as part of the last rites. And you know, we want all the grace we can have. We want all the assurances that we can have. But when it comes to, you know, can I have a kind of mathematical certainty that I or any soul will go to heaven when I die? And the answer to that question is only if you have direct special revelation from God saying so. Otherwise, Catholics are left with a very confident hope. As I was waiting for this call, I was trying to think of a good analogy. And I thought, well, you know, there are some situations where it's like, when you have a national election and all the media is running around taking exit polls.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And they say, well, you know, with 98% of the vote counted, here's how it looks. And of course, it's just a sample. They're not giving you everybody,
right,
you know.
Right.
So you don't really know until you start counting up the Electoral College, right? Sometimes I think in Catholic life, all the exit polls are pointing in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying? But you don't get the absolute certainty until the thing is certified by the vice president, so to speak.
Right. Right. Well, there you go. Appreciate that. And Therese Marie, we hope that's helpful for you. Thank you so much for your call, checking us out on Facebook. All right, let's go now to Alex, who called us back in Anaheim. Alex, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my question. It's sort of a two-parter. I'm a lifelong practicing Catholic, and I've been recently trying to find a parish that celebrates Mass more reverently. Led me to find some really reverent traditional Latin masses in my area, but on that search, I also stumbled upon charismatic masses, neo-catechumenal masses, and a few others that I can't remember. But my question is, why are there so many different liturgical styles out there? What exactly is the charismatic mass and neo-catechumenal mass, and what makes these masses valid if they're so drastically different? I researched a little bit. I think they're different, like, terms of reverence, in terms of reading, sometimes receiving communion differently. So wasn't sure what your thoughts are on all that.
Thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, you know, the church has always had diversity in worship, and the most important diversity is the diversity that exists between Catholic rites, R-I-T-E-S, like the Latin rite or the Byzantine rite or the Maronite rite, the Alexandrian rite, the Chaldean rite. Seven rites, families of rites in the Catholic Church, and they have, you know, completely different liturgies, and of course they would have different conceptions of what is appropriate, what are appropriate forms of reverence. And so the most important thing is, according to whatever rite you attend, and in our case it's the Latin rite, that you have to hew to the forms of reverence that are specified by the Church in the rubrics for Mass. And so whatever else you do, you have to say the black and do the red in the Roman Missal. So when the text says this is what the priest has to say, these are the gestures that he has to make, you have to do those things. And whatever else you might do, if you don't do that, in my judgment, you're not being reverent, all right? I do think, and this is my personal opinion, all right, so you can take it or leave it with a grain of salt, that reverence is more about one's interior disposition than it is about where one puts one's body. Now, obviously, there are some times when the church specifies you must put your body here and in this posture. And I already mentioned that if you're not doing that, then at the very least you're disobedient to the church, and that evidence is an inner disposition of disobedience, like, I know better than the church. Well, that's not the proper disposition.
No,
so
no.
Whatever else is the case, you have to do what the church says. But beyond that, I think when someone tells you, well, you know, to be reverent, you have to do this thing that I do when I go to Mass. If the church doesn't say you have to do this thing, then you don't have to do this thing, whatever it might be. But you can. And that, you know, whether that's in a charismatic Mass or a traditional Latin Mass or what have you, if there are variations, there are allowable variations if they happen with the bishop's permission. Why would there be variations? Well, you know, it's not a rite, but it's a legitimized use of the Latin rite.
Uh-huh.
For African diocese, that's the Mass according to the Zairean use. And if you ever attend one or you watch one on television or the computer, you'll see that the cultural forms of African cultural forms of expression and worship are very much in evidence in ways that would feel quite foreign to us, you know, stodgy Northern European types. Okay, I'll put it that way. And I think, you know, the reason the church allows that variation is quite obvious, is that in one culture, for example, a particular form of instrumentation is historically associated with reverence, whereas in another culture, it would seem quite foreign and out of place. And out of deference to the sensibilities of the local cultural population, the church says, yeah, these kinds of variations are allowable because the sentiments of the people involved can play into the way we interpret and live out the liturgy in the hopes of letting it penetrate more deeply into their consciousness. So this is a poor example, but to illustrate, you know, I have been to Masses where priests, for example, play fast and loose with the rubrics. And these other guys, they're not playing fast and loose, but I'm going to tell this illustration to make a point. Yeah. The priest might depart from the language of the Roman Missal. There are so many problems with that, but not the least of them is that the congregation is sitting there on the edge of its seat, literally, biting its own fingernails, agonizing over, is this thing even going to be valid, you know? And so rather than paying attention to Christ, to the Scriptures, to the Blessed Sacrament, one is tied up with all this anxiety because the liturgy is being butchered in front of your very eyes. So that's an extreme version of this. But, you know, what if you attend a form of worship, a style of worship, where even though it's licit, there's something about it that's so foreign to your personality or culture or way of expression that you still have that kind of fingers on a chalkboard response to it, you know? And the church recognizes that that's a real thing. And so it allows, you know, some regional variation in the way the Mass is celebrated. That's the rationale, always in the hopes that it's in the service of charity. My own judgment on what counts as reverence, again, is more to do with the inner disposition of the love of God and neighbor, charity towards one's neighbor and the virtues, the willing to sacrifice myself for the sake of the good of my neighbor, than it does with questions about where I put my body. And sometimes, like charity towards one's neighbor might require that I sit quietly and bite my tongue, you know, when my neighbor is being edified and I'm not.
Mm.
You know, I have had it happen before that, you know, I'll sit through a homily and I'll be like, oh my goodness gracious alive, what on earth? And then a friend comes up and says, man, that thing really helped me. And I think, oh, say nothing, Anders, say nothing.
Yeah,
bite your tongue, say nothing, you know, and that's what charity demanded in that moment.
Alex, thanks so much for your call. Glad that you were able to get in and for watching us on YouTube. I'm reminded, as you were talking about the regional differences, of a Mass that we attended, my wife and I attended at the Missionaries of the Poor and at their chapel in Kingston, Jamaica. Three drummers. And
that's more than the Grateful Dead.
They laid it down, and it was just absolutely fantastic. You know, the Mass itself was rock solid. There were no, straying off the reservation,
right,
if you will. But just the use of their native music there in Jamaica was just absolutely beyond words.
That's wonderful.
It really, really was. Alex, thanks again for your call. We are out of time. Can't believe it. Another fast-moving hour. Thank you, Dr. David Anders.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday here on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. You can check out the podcast anytime, Monday through Friday. Well, actually, anytime you wish, by going to EWTN.com. Look for the word radio. Click on that radio box and then look for the words Podcast Central. You'll find all of our great podcasts in alphabetical order. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us. Looking forward to our next visit, and that would be tomorrow on the Thursday edition of Call to Communion. Have yourselves a wonderful day, and God bless.